Panos is really a visionary. He's a genius. He's not like anybody else. He makes a movie once every 8 years. His Black Rainbow movie, I didn't sleep for a week after I saw that. Originally, he wanted me to play Jeremiah Sand. I was playing Army of One at that time. I was in Vancouver. I had long white hair and a long white beard. And he said to me, I want you to play Jeremiah Sand. And I said, well, why? He says, because, I think the character's like a California Klaus Kinski. He literally said that. And I said, well, I am the California Klaus Kinski, but I don't want to play Jeremiah Sand. I want to play Red. And he said, well, this is a movie about age versus youth, and I don't see you as Red. Because at that point, I did look like Father Time. I was fully, in Gandalf mode. So it didn't work out. And then about a year later, and Elijah Wood was the one who brought us together, and I'm thankful for Elijah that he did that, but he came up with the idea that I should play Red. And Red was a character that I wanted to portray because I felt I do have the power of imagination, but I also felt I had the life experience to play Red. And having been through love and loss and going through, what was going to be my third divorce, and also my father had passed away, and that really stuck with me. And so I knew I had the emotional content to play Red, because Red is really a being who's contending with loss of love. And it's interesting, because if you look at Panos's notes about the picture, he was contending with the same thing, not in terms of the romantic love, but more in terms of familial love and loss. So we were in step the whole way, and I think we found a way to calibrate the amount of emotion when and where, and then also in terms of body language, in terms of the fight sequences. Before Red drinks the kind of supernatural skull juice, hallucinogen, if you will, that transforms him, Red is much more ferocious as a fighter. And we thought about Bruce Lee, and I showed him an old take of Bruce, Lee and Enter the Dragon, where the camera goes in really quick and he snaps him, and it's like that look, that fantastic, those big eyes. And so I want us to try and get that shot, And that scene, we got it, where the camera came right in. So I was thrilled with that.
All right, guys, let's close out the 420 special month. It's been fantastic so far. I really like our picks. Please go back and watch some Brazil from 1985, Friday from 1995. We got Mandy today. To close out the month, I want to play a little high-low, old pod favorite.
The love of the halfling's leaf has clearly slowed your mother.
All right, guys. We're covering Nick Cage today. And I'm going to say one of my favorite actors, bar none. He just feels like he's been in the background or just in the, oeuvre of what you've been watching since I've been like in high school, middle school. Do you know what I mean? Like thinking of it like Gone in 60 Seconds, National Treasure, all kind of like Nick Cage projects or Face Off, or just like, I just remember you just being in my background. I want to ask you guys this, low high, low, total gross box office Nick Cage over his 20-year career.
Ooh.
Higher or lower than $1 billion. Don't know why I said 20. Actually meant 40. A 40-year span career. And we're going to put some respect on Nick Cage's career here. All right, back to the episode. It's billion with
Did
a
he,
fucking
Is
D.
he a Billy?
Nick Cage, oof. What do we think? Been around forever.
Gross?
Gross. Total gross.
Gross or net? Okay.
gross?
Total gross. Nick Cage, box office.
I want it to be true because he is priceless.
How much did The Rock make? Probably like 300 mil? Easy?
That's a good question.
Probably more.
I don't have that number in front of me, but that is...
I feel like there's
been enough. I know it's amongst his highest grossing. I just don't have the exact number.
What's his highest grossing, I wonder?
Highest grossing films, National Treasure, Book of Secrets, National Treasure, the first film, The Rock, and Gone in 60 Seconds.
Okay, interesting. I didn't expect Gone in 60 Seconds to be that high on the list. I mean,
I can give you a little more clues. Peak earnings. In his peak, he earned approximately $20 million per film of four titles like Gone in 60 Seconds and National Treasure. What do we think?
I want to have faith in it. I feel like he's a $1 billion man.
Yeah, I want to say higher as well.
Heart.
I agree. Higher. I think the National Treasure movie is easy. Push it over. And just the amount of movies he's been in.
Ding, ding. How about $6 billion. How much is this man has generated $6 billion for Hollywood over the course of his career. God. Like, and when I saw the number, I almost didn't believe it. Like, there's no way. So don't quote me. This is just me Googling, doing my best here. So if it's, you know, I don't know, $5 billion, somewhere in that. But it's to be over that, well over that. Yeah, I'm like, gee,
that's
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah.
The person who facts checked that, though, oh, man. Like, let me know. I'm going to record a lecture for the person that decides to reach out to fact check that.
I'm going to mold an axe for whoever decides to fact check that. Yeah, we get into Mandy from 2018 coming up after this. All right, welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Sean McGee and Nat, a.k.a. Uncle Ant. Quick question for you two. How do you guys feel about The Carpenters? I find them sensational.
All the leaves have been brown. That's the mamas and the papas.
I said that immediately.
Oh no.
The leaves are brown. And the sky
leaves are brown.
And the leaves are brown. And the sky is brown. No, I've actually gathered you both here today to force you to listen to my mixtape called God's Special Boy and His Hot Loving Light.
And his hot loving light.
I also really hate the fact you just stole that. That's my band name.
And this is a show where Sean and I trade off forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But today it's Uncle Ant's turn. She's back into the month to close us out for 420, sharing one of her favorite films. I love this one. I'm not going to lie to you. This is not to spoil my reaction or anything like that. This is going to be a really fun one if you like this film. But before we get into all that, let me stop here. Let's go back in the Uncle Ant introduction. Want to get whoever wants to be involved in our Patreon private Uncle Ant's private stash, secret stash. I'm sorry, I'm fucking this up.
Private stash. It's so private that I don't know. It's my stash, baby.
Yeah. Want to get you guys involved with this? Please hit us up in the Patreon.
Which one sounds better, secret or private? Now
I seem to back and forth. I like. Private gave me a little bit more ideas in terms of a logo, and then maybe we could talk about that off mic, but like trying to get something drawn up for that.
I like private stash is what I was imagining, but I do kind of like the alliteration of secret stash, but I've been using private stash.
Yeah. We can talk off mic.
I'm just living.
Yeah. Please hit us up in the Patreon. Give us your, send us your address and we send out little accoutrements that have to do with the show's theme that month, the zine, things Nat kind of stashes in there. Talk to us a little bit about the philosophy of you stashing random things. Is this something that's is just literally random, like some stuff that you have around, or is there sort of an overarching plan that you have every month when you put these together?
Well, besides movies, my favorite subject is, so I love gift giving, period. But I think that there's something to getting something in the mail that is just... There's a reason I put everything in there. There's a continuation of theme for sure happening for me. Whether or not you get it, that's not none of my business. It's like the back of my head. I don't even know what's happening back there. And you both are people in my life that I crow for, where it's like, I will just find little things I think you might like. And then you just get a weird box and it's just full of little things I think you might like. So I just, the way I like to do the Patreon is just kind of keeping that energy for a bunch of people where we all just celebrate the same thing. We just all like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, now you're in it, dude.
I like it. It's a bunch of little random things, but it has to do kind of, I don't know. Maybe I should stop trying to explain it, but it's interesting. And if you want to be a part
either
of it,
you're on the journey or not, exactly. There's no,
it's like in order to make art, you fill up your, bucket of inspiration with the art around you. And it's just like, even those little trinkets of inspiration to, push that forward and let that spill over into someone else's art is, what it's all about, baby.
Yeah, no, I just finished working on a project that was such a bummer because there was no fun in the collaboration. It made me really appreciate all the people I really enjoy collaborating with, because like, I am such a passionate maker and I love to do things and I love to bounce off people. But if I have nothing to bounce off of, it's like, oh, it's not the love, just the love of the game. Yeah. It's love of the community.
Yeah.
And like, that was, that is the one thing this last play taught me. So,
well, hit us up, join our community, send us your, you know, address, and then we'll send you out something every month that has to do with the podcast. It's called Uncle Ann's Private / Secret Stash. We're still working out the logistics on that. Before we get into the rest of the episode, we want to thank.
We'll take a vote.
Exactly. We want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You could be doing anything else with your time. We're happy you're here with us. Please follow our socials in the show notes. While you're scrolling down there, please rate, review, give us 5 stars, support us. And join us on Patreon along with the Secret Stash, Private Stash. We have some entertaining exclusives over there. I want to toss it to McGee. What do you think people could be pairing with Mandy this week?
I mean, we could do another revenge story. We got Fist of Legend in the back.
Oh, nice. Not too,
that long ago.
Nice.
I think has a... It's, you know, what this movie is, what if Jet Li did a shitload of acid halfway through Fist of Legend. But that's a fun episode, too, to go back and check it out.
Love that. And on today's episode, we have Nat's pick for the week and 2018's Mandy. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling and then dive into this film with our world famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind the scenes story. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 2018's Mandy.
Under the crimson, primordial sky, the wretched warlock reached into the dark embrace. Closed around the serpent's eye. Strange and eternal.
I need you to get me that girl I saw. Do you know what to do?
A special one, Mandy. I too am a special one. Let us be so very special together.
So what you gonna do with that thing?
I'm going hunting.
So what you hunting?
It's crazy evil.
You think you're so in love? I'll show you love.
Oh, man. They wronged you. You exude the cosmic darkness.
Glowed from within, strange and eternal.
All right, that was from the trailer of 2018's Mandy. Logline, Red Miller, a broken and haunted man, hunts an unhinged religious sect who slaughtered the love of his life. That's like half of the movie, but, you know, it's hard to sum this up in a log line. Who can blame him? This is directed by Panos Cosmatos, photographed by Benjamin Loeb. This is written by Panos Cosmatos and Aaron Stewart on, starring Nicolas Cage as Red Miller. We got Riseborough. Okay. We got Andrea Riseborough as Mandy Bloom, the titular character. We got Linus Roach as Jeremiah Sand and Bill Duke as Carruthers. Starting with the title of the podcast, as always, thrown now to our guest, our much esteemed guest. Natalie, why did you make us watch this?
Well, it's a prog rock acid trip chainsaw fight about love and revenge. So why wouldn't I want to share that movie with anyone? This movie hits a really like lovely kinship for me of there's a genre I can't stand usually, but finding this movie made me okay with the genre. It's called Dead Wife Learn Karate. It's like whenever someone's like, oh, well, we killed the girl and now I'm the baddest ass man. I can like fight with swords. Like, I hate that. But this one hits me so right. I got to share it. Anytime someone gets me out of my comfort zone with the genre, I love that.
What's the Mount Rushmore of Dead Wife, No Karate?
Oh, you know,
here's the thing. My mind went, is it the same?
My mind went John Wick, because we got John not Wick's only the wife, there. But the dog.
Kill Bill's up there, I think.
See, that's more the, yeah, it's a reverse, which is why.
Kill Baby Learn Karate. Well, she also knew karate.
She also knew karate, and like it's like husband, baby, all her friends.
Yeah. But like, I'm thinking more of just a trope you see in like a horror movie.
Death where Wish. It's like, okay, is so a terrible all of a
sudden,
of
all of a sudden, dad can rip someone's arms off. Yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that thought experiment about how many guys think that they could land a plane in an emergency.
Yeah.
But I get it. It's a fantasy.
I could land the plane. I get it's, you know, a flaw of men in general, but also I'm pretty sure I could land the plane.
You might be one of the few people where I think your bold confidence would just, it'd be a rough one, but the plane would listen to me. And you never shut up about it.
You'll wish I crashed the plane.
Can I ask you, were you like right on top of this film in 2018? Because I remember.
Baby. Opening weekend.
Yeah.
At the Music Box. Maybe a little altered. We'll put it that way. And then I had to have a moment where I'm like, I need to watch this again. With clear eyes, can't lose. And then we'll see how it is. And I have probably seen it in theaters 3 to 4 times. We played it at my birthday party in the lounge there. And yeah, this is like one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Top 10. One of my top 3 favorite romances too.
Were your expectations, like what were your expectations before seeing the film? Like, were you a fan of Panthers? Like, did you see, is it Under the Black Rainbow?
Yeah,
like,
I heard, the way that I had heard it described while Black Rainbow was looking in, like Mandy was acting out. And because like the moments of like loss and introspection were so intense with Black Rainbow, I'm like, all right, let's see what this is. And plus, like, you watch the trailer and that's how to get me in a trailer, baby. Yeah,
fantastic. Yeah.
That's
trailer.
How to get me.
Fantastic trailer. amazing.
I'm a sucker for bisexual lighting.
Amazing.
This was at the height of it too. I think that was one of the things that like, there were a lot of things when this movie came out in 2018. I think I missed it initially because it was kind of at that height of like everybody was doing the bisexual lighting.
Oh,
Nick
that like
Cage
a real,
was in a bunch of weird
industry?
Fucking movies.
Oh yeah, where it's like a lot of like I kind of almost have bisexual lighting if I had like a blue one right here. Right
yeah.
Now. What's the color scheme? Like what's the,
it's just that like
bisexual
that,
lighting. What does that mean?
Oh, well, it ends up being the colors of the bisexual flag is why we call it bisexual lighting.
Oh, okay.
And then it became like a joke, I think, and also like the queer community for a while. But yeah, bisexual lighting, John Cage, wow. Nick Cage movies are like they all line up to be under the umbrella of the weird stuff that Elijah Wood has been producing.
Yeah, this film included.
So this is like a nerve. This is like a gold mine of goodies for me. Is that the like horror movies with bisexual lighting? Oh, so good.
Mickey, you feel the same?
So I think I got kind of burnt out on it just because of the timing. Like this is when I was still in LA, and the technology that came up got really cheap. Like the LED, like programmable color, like the color science got way better on the LEDs. So it became much more accessible to do these kind of digital color, like gradients. And so everybody started kind of rushing to do them at the same time. So to be honest, I was a little turned off from this. I missed it in theaters. I didn't like, you know, that's why I haven't watched it until now. Natalie making us is it was just one of those things that I was burnt out on, because every music video I had been working on for the past 3 years had been doing it. And as the technology got cheaper, it just was getting more and more ubiquitous. And I was just like, I want to see something different. I want to see something new. So
it was the lighting just,
it's the purple, pink, blue, like gradient specifically, where you're using the like contrast between the like purple and the pink to give it kind of a, there's no white in the frame. It's just everything has a color wash over it, which is something this movie does a lot with like just like the solid red and like filters and stuff too, where I think that's what, if I had given it a chance and actually watched the movie, I would have realized that this wasn't as big of a, it wasn't like succumbing to those same sins that I was like being paranoid about, because it is doing like full red washes, like really just like psychedelic kind of distortion-y sort of things in general, and just really, really, really crunchy contrast, where there's times where it feels a little underlit at times, but it earns it, because it's like usually only underlit when it is trying to hold back from showing you the full depth of something. So it's being underlit intentionally so as to leave mystery. And then so that's like, oh, well, that doesn't bother me either. So it's like it's playing in a lot of spaces where it's like things that would bother me in many other movies that I don't think other movies have used well previously, where this movie somehow pulls them off, which is, I know, not the most glowing praise, but it is actually something that is incredibly impressive to me.
For sure. Aside from the lighting, were you a fan of the film? Like, I guess you're saying that the narrative, the structure, narrative, performance salvaged a bit of like what you didn't.
I think there's a lot of it. It's not my type of movie for sure, but it was something that I found very impressive to watch, and it made me very excited of like, for it's the type of movie that makes me enjoy movie making in general as an art form, where I'm like, yeah, like this movie would have ripped ass in the theaters. Like, I'm very jealous of your theater experience. And like, to like, you know, kind of speed run to the end here of like, would I put this on again? It's like, I don't see me putting this on to watch just like some evening and where it's going to pop into my head and I'm going to throw it on for me. But if I ever see somebody screening this in a theater, I'm fucking going to watch this in a theater. Like, it seems like
Metal Movie Madness does it about once a year.
Yeah. And that's like a can't miss.
And like, just, it's worth it. It is so worth it. It's so worth it.
But yeah, it's so good. I liked it. I'm not like crazy about it. There's parts of it that I, you know, were like, eh, whatever. But then it more than makes up for any of its like small parts where it gets a little cringy or whatever. Like, so I see a little bit through the like stage effect of it all. But like, for what they pull off, it's absolutely incredible. Well, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, though.
Yeah.
Bring me home.
So I think this is probably the best film Nat's put on, bar none. I'm not gonna lie to you. Like, beyond Valley, beyond Tootsie, beyond Barbarella, this is my favorite movie that she's put on, and it was just so crazy because I thought I thought I was gonna hate it.
I was so nervous. I knew you were doing it for me. I knew you were just doing it for me
because I do not. The audience, I mean, you should. Maybe every comic is somebody's first comic. So maybe it's every episode somebody's first episode. If you don't know me, I hate body horror. Like, I don't like watching, you know, I'm not a hostile Eli Roth fan with the, like, cutting people's tendons or watching people.
To be
like,
fair, his gore is the best thing about his writing.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of that at all. Like, I don't like body horror. I don't like Cronenberg kind of films. So seeing this and not knowing anything about, is it Panthos? Panthos? It's Panthos. Not knowing much about his work, like, I've seen the trailer for Under the Black Rainbow, I believe it is.
I love you just being like, I saw the trailer and that was enough.
Yeah, I was like, it feels like that's gonna be too intense. Like, I feel like I see what we're getting into, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to handle that for like two hours.
When we get you here, when we get you to Illinois, can we just have a viewing party together?
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll just be me staring at you too intently. What you think?
Absolutely.
Fucking cool, brothers.
we're in the small theater and music box, and you just have like a cuck chair facing us, watching us.
Yes,
just the biggest thing of popcorn, though. Just a huge thing of popcorn.
Yes, I thought I was really going to hate this one. I was really dreading the screening of this one when Nat brought it up, you know, for the end of the movie. I'm like, I can just tell. And I saw the still of this one of Nick Cage who covered all the blood. So I'm like, this is going to be fucking terrifying. But this, for those who are like kind of horror sensitive, like myself, knowing how visceral the violence is going to be is a big part in like how am I going to engage with this film. And, you know, to put everyone at ease, if you're more of my camp, this hits in more of like the Hitchcockian vein of like impressionistic violence. And we do, I mean, there are definitely some gory bits, and at the end there's a, you know, a gory bit, but it's much more left up to your imagination. And I'm not saying this like postures in a way, but tone is a big part of Panthos's like toolbox, and like really creating like distinct images, and like I don't know, doubling vocals and using all kind of like film tricks that like make you feel like this is fucking eerie and unsettling in the way that it's.
That's one of the best things about this movie, is even if you were like stone cold sober in a middle of the day, it is one by the end that you're like, did I take something?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is, because it uses every single sense that you can experience through cinema to like warp your like sense. Mm-hmm. Like it messes with your sight. It messes with your hearing. Mm-hmm. Like the way that they even use, like the way that the score just kind of pulls you out is just so phenomenal.
The score is so good.
And she's just like, geez.
I've been getting really into dungeon synth because I've been thinking about this movie so much. Oh, wow. So dungeon synth, if you like the
tunes of this one. Oh yeah, I think he takes a simple thing and he does it at the highest possible clip. Like this is a very, if you made the story any more complex than I feel like this like real simple revenge tale, I think you may lose a little something in the chemistry here. I think making a very simple, this cult took this girl and now actually, you know, we're gonna beep that out. Sorry, we're in non-spoilers. Apologies. That allows for you, like, or Nat brought up, is to use every other sensory experience to kind of create this really weird, fantastical world that's like demonic and romantic and special all at the same time. Very, very cool stuff going on here. I want to reserve a little bit of criticism for my compliment sandwich, because I have one aspect that I want to hit you with that I think is a little bit self-indulgent for Panthos. Or I haven't seen Black Rainbow, so I'm not sure if he does this in the same thing. But there's a bit I want to ask you about, if it could have been made a little stronger. Save that for a little bit after the break. But yeah, those are my feelings. Really, like, I dug.
I'm so happy.
As far as, to spoil my, if I got to press play on this again, absolutely, because I feel like this is going to be like, this is going to be one of the things where like I could be brave enough to watch during like October or something like that. Like, so it's like, oh, what's your horror pick, or do you have something you could put on? Like, I could tolerate this. Like, I like this pick here. So if we're in the range of this kind of violence and horror, like this is tolerable for me. I like this. Yeah, this is going on in October.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, it's one that I put on for a lot of people, because I think sometimes if we can't say we want more original movies and then not see original movies.
Yeah.
And so like, and be like, oh, but what if it's bad? Yeah. Well, what if it is? What if it's great? And so the amount of bad movies I've seen, up to here, but the amount of good movies I've seen mean the world. So watch more original movies when they're in theaters, guys. We'll get more then.
How do we watch this one this week?
Oh, I've got the Blu-ray.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Is that more than the making? There's a 20-minute making of on the digital copy on VOD.
Yeah, there's not a ton of features on it. I've mainly like listened to interviews, but when it was touring the music box, got some like swag from it, and that was one of the things where I'm like, no doubt. And I'm not someone who typically like buys the DVD for newer movies. Like, I just don't. Like, or I won't like. Not for newer movies, because I know that they'll be more accessible. I mainly spend my money on older stuff. So that was a weird purchase for me. So
yeah, if you do get any copy, I think the little documentary behind the making of this is interesting to watch and kind of to see the guy behind this, you know,
yeah,
fan, I don't know, tastical nightmare. It's really interesting to kind of, it kind of looks a little like McGee. I'm not going to lie to you.
I didn't watch any of it, so I don't know what that means.
A bit of McGee.
I don't know whether
vibes.
Or not I'm to be mad at that. But I did. This is also available streaming on Plex and Pluto and Roku. Nice. So if you're on a budget
Shudder,
this week.
Shudder, if you're into horror at all.
Yeah, Shudder's a phenomenal, definitely is a phenomenal one to support.
Streaming surface, yeah.
I didn't pop up on the list when I was looking. Sorry, but yeah.
Well, that's all right. I'll talk about Shudder.
Can we talk scenes you might show to get somebody to watch?
This is hard because if you show somebody a scene from the first half of the movie, you're not preparing them for the second half, and if you know, vice versa.
What? I think I could solve that. I think I have that solved. Can I hit you guys with
all right?
Scenes?
Let me hear it.
Yeah,
first half. I went with the granny goodness pitch. So her bringing Mandy in the kitchen, I think that whole thing is so disturbing. Kind of explaining. And then you did like the pitch of him, like, I'm Jeremiah, God, blah, 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 Carpenters, lead into that scene for the first half. The second half, the Bill Duke trailer scene, chef's fucking kiss. Everything about how that scene out is incredible. And like him just, they did the whole like when you do these complex sci-fi scenes or films and you have that scene that sort of like explains the drama, or you have the exposition dump. Like this had the exposition dump, but it's like kind of funny, like hearing fucking Nick Cage and like explain what's going on. Incredible. I think so. Granny goodness first half, Bill Duke second half are my choices.
Yeah, no, I think that's solid. The Bill Duke one was also what I was thinking. I think I was considering like cutting in. You could cut in just the like her, the cult passing her in the bus while she's walking on the side of the road. Like just intercut that footage in with the Bill Duke scene. And that's a free teaser right there without any. The trailer for this is fantastic.
You could
have did
a 60 second teaser. Absolutely with that. Yeah.
See, I'm like going a very different way. Is my thought is who am I trying to convince to watch this? If you're like a basic, if you are just like someone where I'm like, the closest thing I can get you into like a trauma or like something, it has to be like in the world of Freddy and Jason, I would do the chainsaw fight.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that chainsaw fight for the right person, they'll sit through a lot of movie. If they know that that's there. I also think that if it was someone who like doesn't like campier gory horror movies, showing the scene of him flipping shit in the bathroom, because it's such a deeply emotional, visceral scene where I'm like, yeah. And it also tells you what you're getting into
where he's drinking. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's such an evocative scene and so uncomfortable. And the best bathroom.
It's a good midpoint too.
That shot's actually coming up in our shot for shot segment. But let's get into the film's opening. Very curious what you guys think about this. Coming up after this.
All right, welcome back from the break. We are in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film, starting with the start in that big bang. Does that opening sizzle or fizzle? We'll throw to our esteemed guests. Natalie, what are your thoughts on this opening?
So, if we're counting like the first chapter as like the opening, I think that this sets this up for being one of the most romantic movies on the planet, and let me tell you why. So with Mandy, this is someone that we do not see her consume anything. The only thing she like does is like she watches TV or she reads. Like she is, like she doesn't take anything from anyone else. It's all her giving something. And she's always painting. She's always drawing. She's always like making something happen. She is creation. And then Red is a logger. And so there's an enhanced destruction to that. That you can
say
tell
that one
like,
more time. You said enhanced
bit,
destruction.
Yeah, inherent destruction to being a logger. And so the fact that they like found each other and have made this peace where it's like she's allowed to be soft and be protected, and then he is able to like be tamed in its own way, which I know sounds so trad wifey, but there's like some, I think everyone on this planet, if we're being real with ourselves and the way that we relate to people, like there is a beautiful sense of peace and home in someone that you can connect with that takes all the things that you wish you could tame about yourself and pulls it back and gives you a safe space to be. And yeah. So it kind of adds to that duality. So then when something does happen to Mandy and she's taken away from us, it's not creation and destruction together. It's just motherfucking destruction, baby.
Yeah, it's a yin yang.
It's not hindered. It's so balance, beautiful. Yeah. And we have to know her as a person too. She's like keeping him awake with trauma dumping, which is also a very relationship thing to do. So can I tell you something sad that happened to me as a child?
I'm glad that it's, later. It's not just like her under a bed sheet in like backlit by the sun, like your traditional dead wife from the Dead Wife No Karate genre. Yeah. With
like one piece of paint on her face. Like, I just did the nursery. I hope nothing happens to me.
Let's do pottery together. It'll turn into sex that will be used for a flashback later.
It is super stylized, but I do think it has the bones of like a traditional romantic, like a rom-com opening. Like he's at his job or she's, you know, working, like they're doing things in the kitchen together. Like it feels like there's a little bit of that there, but it's in the heavy metal Fangoria magazine style version of that.
In a house just made of windows because they have nothing to hide.
So not necessarily a big bang, but a slow bang. Like a nice
it's tantric. It's a very tantric opening. All
right. something maybe noticed in this viewing that you hadn't noticed before.
I noticed the blonde kid getting fucking taken into the shadows during the sacrifice there.
Hilarious.
I definitely didn't catch.
What's sad about that is because he Jeremy Sand, right? It feels like I can't remember exactly what he says about him in that living room
when they're talking shit.
Give him the porker.
And then I kind of forgot about that.
He couldn't
see
his nose in the mirror, or whatever he fucking says.
That was amazing. You just see him get taken. He's just like,
and then you see him later in the biker's hangout, not all in one piece.
Where?
That's one of the things that's hidden in the dark. Oh, he's like in one of the bedrooms when Red opens the door.
Oh, is he is he the guy that's laid over the girl
with like parts of his back?
Oh, I thought that I didn't realize that was him.
No, that was our little Gabriel boy. That was our little curly haired angel.
That was like an old. So he looked older in that one. Yeah. Okay. I didn't notice it. Wow. I love that.
Oh, I mean, I've also seen it in theaters a bunch of times. So, like, there's a lot of the stuff that kind of hides when you watch it at home.
Do we know who's under him? Like, there's another body that he's laying on top of. We're just supposed to.
I'm sure this is another person they've killed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not someone we maybe have met in the film or something. Because I didn't realize that was him.
Let's call her Gwyneth.
They just throw him on the meat pile. Let's call her Gwyneth.
Compliment sandwich. Can I make you guys a little something right now? Okay. So, this is the only.
I'm hungry.
This is the only bit that I think where the stylization felt a little self-indulgent. And that's with the, like, I love the narrative split of the film. There are very, you know, distinctive parts and halves, and we get into chapters in this one. But I think I needed the chapters, like the Shadow Mountain, Children of the New Dawn, and Mandy. Like, I think I needed them. Mandy's the one that hits the most. And I was trying to decipher, why do I feel like, let's say in the work of Tarantino, we've all seen Kill Bill most recently. For whatever reason, Tarantino's chapters hit a little bit more. Like when I see the title, we cut into whatever the Chiron's going to be. And then we kind of sink into that story. And I think there's something about reinforcing, like if the chapter is Bill and then we learn a lot about Bill, the chapter title meant a little bit more. What I'm seeing here, and I'm getting like the
Weapons
Shadow Mountains.
Does a really good job of it too.
Yeah, is that right? I don't know. Do you guys feel the same? Like when I'm seeing Shadow Mountains, I'm like, I almost forgot that we were doing that. And then we cut into another channel. Yeah. We do another Children of the New Dawn. I'm like, oh yeah, we were doing a chapter. And it's like, we didn't necessarily reinforce what that meant in a way. I don't know if you guys feel the same way. I like the idea. So it just felt a little kind of,
The references that it is making are very niche. is the best way to put it. Mm. It's like, I can't sit here and be like, well, man, if only, you know, all the prog rock albums you just sit and listen to from like start to finish, brother, and just jam out. Yeah, I don't think that's in your
right. I mean, I mean, yeah. Target audience.
But it's that's the
as,
how
as
I
has been established
some,
from the Trick or Treat episode, I think, and Wayne's World.
It's a yeah, it's how I usually like pitch it to older guys. Like if I'm talking to like a dude at a record store that I'm trying to make be less mad at me for some reason, I'm like, have you seen Mandy? It's like a structure. It's a action movie structured like a prog rock album. Oh, maybe I'll check that out. And I'm like, yeah, no, please do.
And you're saying these titles have that sense sequentially
yeah,
of an
album?
Yeah,
so they have that like same feels- like how that because like not all prog rock albums, but a bunch that are like more storytelling based are like literally done in an old school arc. And yeah. So that's how they break up the chapters and tonalities of the album.
That's
and so it kind of, it's niche. It's very niche.
What do you think? Where do you land on that?
Is a good. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was asking. Yeah. Where do you land on this? Where do you?
I was saying because I was kind of more on board with you initially where it does. I kind of forget that they exist because they. Which is me, you know, not the harshest criticism of it because it's not like it's ruining anything for me, but also it doesn't feel essential. But when it, relating it to like sides of a record, like this is side A of record one, this is side two, B, and like so on, so forth, like that's like okay, that kind of clicks it into place more where they make a little bit more sense. Did you have a end of your compliment sandwich
before? Yeah, it's like I like the idea because I think there are distinct stories here and he's splitting the narrative in a way. I just wish he incorporated the chapter titles in a stronger way that made me feel I bring back the Tarantino example, like when he does a chapter thing, it feels definite. It feels like I know.
Yeah. Well, because it's a name, like it's a name versus like the Shadow Mountains is like when he is.
So maybe it's a framing thing. Like maybe I need a stronger title for it.
Well, I mean, I think that it's. I don't think it's the most effective because I know that I'm giving it a like, oh, I can see where it's coming from. But like it doesn't. But in a way, this movie sucks me in so hard. Mm-hmm. Those things allow me to step back again.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, oh, all right, now take a break. It's like having an alarm in a bad dream is kind of what it feels like to me. And it like kind of gives you that that release after
I feel
all,
like the film itself, even just like the elliptical editing of the film, like we're always kind of like closing up a bit and then reopening in another. It feels like
it breathes.
Yeah. It really feels like it does that for sure. Fading in, fading out. Like it feels like Nick like wakes up in certain spots just randomly. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, where the fuck am I? And
he's having a great day. Yeah. My review of Mandy, Nick Cage is a great day.
A typical day. An Nick average Cage day for out. Nick Cage. Yeah. A day in the life. Get ready with me, Nick Cage.
Behind the scenes with Nick Cage.
It's him just taking the pinky and acid.
Yeah, that's the most unrealistic part of that entire,
Speaking of this entire movie. Speaking of which, acid. I don't know what you guys' history is, blah, blah, blah. But so let's say you guys have indulged. it's a psychedelics in this way. Actually, I know you guys have indulged. It's a psychedelics in this way. I would never follow that up with a bee sting. It would never even occur to me
Funny.
Help me understand what the cherry on top is. It was so eerie. I like as far as setting her up as just being this like,
yeah,
I think it's because
what is that?
It like kind of hark. I mean, there's a lot of hallucinogens that are, you know, mild venoms or mild poisonings, and
like
it's your, you know,
mild
poisoning is the name of my prog rock band.
But so I think tying that in, like trying to combine those two sensations, you know, your body's pumping adrenaline into your system and trying to fight the venom at the same time that you're tripping balls, and it's like the combination of all of those things in your system at once, giving like an enhanced high, and also just makes the cult more ominous that one of the things that they do to indoctrinate you is like inducing pain in order to hallucinate in this way as like
and
such a fundamental part.
And calling it a
part.
Cherry on top, like something like, yeah. like a little something lovely at the end. You're like, oh,
because the there's like a difference
taking
between
the little dropper to a dome. Yeah. Yeah. But
it's the like Manson, you know, the Manson hysteria panic of the 70s and 80s of like cults and serial killers and demonic influence and everything, where it's taking like people that the hippies that were just having a good time doing drugs, and then the culture that was terrified of these like serial killers, and conflating the two ideas into like, oh yeah, these hippies are stinging each other with poisonous wasps because they love how it makes them feel. They fucking love it. Like, I think that's the like the panic and hysteria of the like satanic panic of the times, like wrapped up in a really like ominous imagery.
For sure.
Well, that's like, I think the beauty of this movie is it's Panos describes it as the like Fangoria, like heavy metal looking aspect of 1982 or 1983. It just felt like a fantasy world. So he just made a fantasy where the fantasy setting was like this year or it was 1983. Yeah. But like the fact that you can just like play an ocarina and get a biker gang to show up. And we have so many deep levels of mythology that we're playing with loosely enough to where you're like, when you see things that might be similar, you're like, wait a minute, are you Abraxas?
Oh no. This is just a Call of Cthulhu game, huh?
You said this is all a what game?
I said this is just a Call of Cthulhu game. Okay. I know Eric doesn't know what that is.
I was like,
is,
I don't get either reference, but I'm like,
Call of Cthulhu is like, it's D&D, but Lovecraft. Like, and
people get like, it's a whole, having that game explained to you is one of my rings of hell.
Yeah, I bet.
Is like, it's that kind of game.
This narrative is how the average, I was actually realizing that I think Call of Cthulhu might be the best chance of getting Eric to play our role-playing game. But it is essentially the arc of this movie sounds like your average retelling of a Call of Cthulhu game, where it's like complete insanity. Everyone dies. And then there's like, you know, and then I rampage through with an axe and you're like, whoa, the genre's absolutely changed here. When did this go from horror movie to action movie?
I want to play a bit of a morality game with you two. A little priest, Buddhist and rabbi walking out of this screening of Mandy. What do they think? Righteous Revenge. Very curious on this take. So we've covered a few revenge films. McGee brought up one, Fist of Legend, that we've covered in the past. Kill Bill, we've been bringing up a little bit in this episode. What are our thoughts on, like, the guy that finds somebody, you know, I don't know if you guys heard that court case in Texas, the guy finding somebody, like, messing with his kid in like, a barn and ends up, like, almost, like, a half to death or something like that and ends up serving a little time. You really kind of sympathize when you see somebody's loved one attacked, hurt, something like that, and they take it maybe a little over the edge. Where do we judge Red, those kind of archetypes, those kind of people you find, you know, in a cover, and they just you know, thou shalt not kill, but you take it to an area in which you're like, I'm sorry, guy. You crossed the line.
Hey, you buddy, you knock it off. You sad sack of potatoes, get out here.
Why I gotta?
Straight to the moon, Jeremiah Sands.
What do we think?
I mean, I hate to like plead the fifth, but I'm definitely more in the... Welcome back from the break. We're going under the lights, breaking down performances. Starting out, I mean, our titular, I guess, Mandy.
Andrea Riseborough.
Andrea Riseborough, yeah. Just like, what a perfect, absolute perfect casting as the like, the like 70s, 80s horror face is perfect. Mm-hmm. Her performance is fantastic, specifically when they're doing like that light changing shot at the end. Mm-hmm. And it's just so fucking heartbreaking and so beautiful. But the she has like this perfect combination of horror movie and like religious iconography where like she could be a model for
Madonna.
Like painting. Yeah, I was going to say paintings of Mother Mary or also like screaming face covered in blood. And she works effortlessly in both. But I found her really fucking captivating. What were you guys' kind of standouts?
Yeah, I like.
Well, I thought.
We covered her a little bit before in Death of Stalin, and she was Svetlana. She was Stalin's daughter. She ends up being Stalin's daughter, and she's like she does like the hysterical bit in that film. I like her. Like she has a look. How do you put this? She has almost like a. Like almost a Shelley Duvall kind of thing about her.
It's otherworldly.
Yeah. It's like she always kind of looks like a little panicked. Like she always looks like she's a little like frightened. Or like she has a little bit like a wide eye kind of like, oh shit, kind of a little bit like to her face, like her performance is a little bit.
The phrase Dickens would use is her face is wrought with drama.
Yeah, absolutely. And just adding a scar here now, like a visual, just like it, like really kind of hyper focusing in on that eye. And she's a performer that really performs with the face. I liked everything that she does inside of the whatever the hippie living room of like playing.
Oh God, relatable content there is like laughing so hard at a guy for making me listen to his band that I get set on fire. That's how I'm gonna go. Just me being like, you did this and it's about you.
So
go ahead.
I also want to bring up I'm gonna butcher this, but I think it's Olin Foree.
That's exactly. I was about to talk about.
Yeah, his mother Marlene. Jesus,
she's so good. What's wild? Okay, so I saw her earlier in a movie. I think I brought up one time on the pod when I was bitching about it. The Watchers.
Yeah, she's in The Watchers.
She's in The Watchers.
Shyamalan's kids. Film.
Yeah, the Ishana Shyamalan's. She like so much of the weight of that movie is put on her shoulders to just carry. And she's not given nearly enough depth in that movie to do anything with it. So she's just kind of being like giving you the mood that the movie needs by just doing like horror movie shit. And so seeing her flourish in this movie with like a little bit more meat on the bone.
Right.
Where she's so menacing with how sweet she is in the like in the scene when she's like at the convenience store like just like waves. Checking up on her. What'd you say?
Lapping the rocky shore. Yeah,
I could love you, or best lover you ever had, like sweet waves.
Oh my god. Oh fucking shit.
Oh, what a line.
Sensitivity and empathy.
Like what a scene. The delivery of that.
Well, and she's so beautiful. Like she's beautiful in exactly the way where I'm like, someday if I could look like that as an old woman, get out of here with me. Y'all can't take old lady Natalie if that's what I look like.
That she's
oh my god, it'd be over for all of you.
Also Ned Dennehy as a brother Swan, and this is his bald right hand man. Also a really unsettling performance, and there's like that empty doe-eyed complete like
girl, the girl that's like looks like she's
in Ned also, but they all kind of share that like sort of like blank stare horror obsession sort of like.
Yeah,
like buying all that like guy, yeah, like that yeah. It's just like oh my god, he's so oh
it's
oh,
the like the other, just like yeah. bliss. It's the like rap. The yeah. like weird mindless bliss.
Yeah,
that everyone has up to different levels of just like they're all like
well that's my thing.
Thrilled I don't think it with their like position. Bliss.
Yeah. Oh, you I mean, you it's disagree? Like
I'm it's like a distorted, like perverted yeah. bliss.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
it's a perverted bliss. I also think Linus Roche did a fun, like the ability to play a psychopath is something where everyone thinks they're good at it, like three people are, because they all do the same psychopath performances. But him being able to be at simultaneously terrifying and pathetic.
And
how, like the times, like when he switches,
like that's what I wanted,
when he goes like, tell me what to do in the mirror over and over and over again. And then you see his face switch. It's just like, never doubt yourself. Like that moment when I first saw it, like chills went up down my spine and I was just like, oh, I know people that talk to themselves like that. Oh, shit.
Like, I love the ambiguity of the, like, is he actually a conduit for some Lovecraftian, like, otherworldly force? Or is this just, like, a man who's perverted and broken?
I think perverted and broken and found a special toy is the way that I like to think about it. It's like Gollum finding the ring.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what happened.
What do you guys think of Bill Duke's story where he mentions there was a courier for LSD and they upset them somehow. And then they gave them they cooked them up a special batch and they were never right since. Was this family, were they the couriers? Is this the who got poisoned by the LSD?
No, the bikers. The bikers are, that's why they're like addicted to pain now. And they're like Hellraiser.
The movie itself
too has a bunch of love letters to classic horror. Like, I mean, they live in Crystal Lake. You know, Cenobites.
Is that Freddy or Jason? Is that that's Jason, right? Crystal Lake's Jason.
That's Jason. Yeah. There's, and then like he's silently hunting like Michael. Like there's a bunch of things too that if you are like an old school like 80s, like you know top five horror movie guys, you would find a lot of stuff here that you'd like.
Yeah.
References.
Can I get you guys with a little multiverse casting couch? I heard in the background about Panthos kind of imagining Cage as Jeremiah Sand at the beginning, or they were auditioning him as a Jeremiah Sand. What does a Jeremiah Sand as Nick Cage performance look like to you guys? Like, or would you want to see him in that role? Is there somebody, if we were to kind of switch those roles, what do we
think? Y'all see Long Legs?
No. You know, I didn't see Long Legs. Fuck no. I'm not watching
Bitch,
it.
I don't know.
I'm not watching that shit.
Okay. Like, I'm just, you're a man of multitudes. I'd like to respect that in your big ass age. But yeah, so he, in Long, I hated Long Legs. I thought that, just watch Silence of the Lambs and it'll be better. But if all they gave me was the 15 second clip of Nick Cage going, "Hail Satan!" Like in the like crazy Long Legs makeup, that would have been enough.
Wait, is Long Legs the vampire one or what's the?
No, it's like this stupid. Oh my God. It's a movie about like, oh, there's a serial killer out stealing little girls. Oh no, it's actually the devil. And I don't care about spoiling it because if it's spoiled for you, good, you won't watch it. It's a bad movie. I will send y'all the clip. That is all you need to see of the movie, and that is valid in and out of itself. Oh, I hated Long Legs. Oh,
McGee, what you
anyway.
Think?
Anyway,
switching
about Long Legs.
No. Nick Cage is.
No, I'm joking.
Nick Cage is Jeremiah Sand. Work for you?
I think that it would have been more. That's kind of like what I would have expected more, I guess. Where that's like kind of a big wacky role for him to do. And it fits more in line with the like crazy Nick Cage, like pop
culture.
Yeah,
I think he would chew up the scenery a little bit more than I would.
Yeah, I agree.
Than already can be done.
When he's asked.
I love him as silent, scary.
I agree. There's something. I mean, he was doing what? Like, did you guys see Pig or was it Pig?
I love Pig.
Yeah, where he's.
Hey, Sean, oh no. Guess you should watch Pig now.
I've been conflating the two, honestly. I keep forgetting that they're different movies.
Pig is a very different vibe.
It's
Pig is what happens like about 20 years after Mandy is the way we should
I pitch that.
I like
hey,
it.
Hey little girls, your daddy gone.
Jesus.
So let me to like kind of riff off of that that multiversal casting. I think there was one role here that if I were producing this movie, I would try to pick this role to stunt cast somebody big. I think the chemist could have been the chemist was a wasted opportunity. Not that Richard Brake did a bad job in the role. I think he was perfectly adequate. I think he looks a little bit too much like Jeremiah Sand visually. Not that I confuse them for the same person, but it was just like got a little repetitive of just like a balding old white guy.
Let me hit you because you're gonna appreciate this as a Venture Brother fan. Who was old boy that was in David Bowie's band? And
Klaus Don't Me?
Is that who he like smoked the cigarettes? I thought it was.
It's Iggy Pop.
I thought that that's who that was.
Iggy Pop would have been
a great pick to Iggy just Pop play that role because he's already zonked out of his fucking brain. So it, like, just putting some dramatic music out behind him would have fucking worked perfect. But I think
that scene though is phenomenal, and I love how it's acted. The like
that's what I'm saying. I don't think he did a bad job. I don't think he did a bad job at all. I just think that if I was making,
who would you cast?
Like as producing. That's where I'm like the first one that popped in my head was Charles Dance. Last Action Hero, and he's Tywin in Game of Thrones.
Steve Buscemi would have been funny.
That's pretty funny.
That would have been a good one for me.
Buscemi.
That would be really good to do.
Tom Waits.
I was literally just thinking. Tom Waits, just riffing off of Iggy Pop.
Doug Jones would be great. Like a really, really tall, lanky.
Oh, just doing Doug Jones James as Redhorn. Himself.
James Redhorn would have been incredible in this.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know how old is James?
So you're right. It is really, really good stunt casting. I do think he did a great job. I would like, I feel like his mom, I'd never replace him for anything, but you're right. That role could be.
Right. It just seems like it's a primo role too. Get in, especially when you're already kind of doing that with Nick Cage, where like, and I think most of the times when I'm having a problem with this movie, it's with weird choices that we're indulging Nick Cage in, which I get that he's bringing a lot to the movie as well.
That's my shit. Yeah. Or you mess with my shit. I hate
that.
My compliment sandwich is some of the lines.
Oh, yeah. Him doing the neck snap with the weird smile. The one that bothers me the most, though, which is also one of those things where I'm like, I'm not even blaming Nick Cage in this one. I'm blaming like the maybe Panos, maybe the editor. I don't know who really is ultimately to blame for this. But when he lights the cigarette off of the flaming head, it takes like four fucking cuts for him to light the cigarette. And it's too much. I get that he did it on the day. And like looked at the cigarette and then looked at the flame and had the idea, then bent down to do it. We don't need five shots to tell this story about how he thought to light the cigarette on the skull. This is a one shot,
that,
two shot.
It implies that he had to make the choice. It is him saying, not like it's a fucked up thing to light a cigarette on a corpse. It is showing that he has crossed over from like all things that make you human to now needing to sort of consume the fire of one of his defeated.
I think it tells that same story if we did it in two shots instead of five. I think seeing him go through the steps in his brain, it feels like Nick Cage is acting for a different edited movie. Like he's giving edit points in his performance and they're holding in long shots where it's like, I don't think Nick Cage knew that you were going to be holding the camera on him this long. I think he's expecting you to have cut away at this point because he's like, takes a drag and then bugs his eyes out real big. And it's like, yeah, cut at that. Don't make him do that transition. I don't know.
But I might be more indulgent than you.
And I think
we can just, yeah.
Because it didn't bother me as much. I know I know the shot you're talking about. I had the feeling that it occurred to me was that it felt like we cut like the 180 in a weird way. Because the way he's looking at it and the way he picks it up and then the way that it appears in his hand was a little awkward. But I like.
You're right. He wouldn't want to disassociate the viewer at all. That's not what this movie's going for.
But again, yeah, we're in this kind of tone of like being kind of jerked around a little bit about this movie. So it just didn't. It felt like in line of what we were getting before. So, and I liked a little, you know, Nick Cage obviously is being, you know, really cagey in this one. So it was, So anyway, we're going to move on to best line reads.
What a transition.
From
one of the worst lines to talking about the best.
Bill Duke and Nick Cage. So what you hunting? Jesus freaks. Mm-hmm. I didn't know they was in season, man. Oh, chef's kiss. Love that line. I love that back and forth. What do you guys got?
Oh, mine is for sure the "This is about you." You wrote this?
Yeah.
I just like the way that that is delivered is so good. It's so good. Yeah. Like I straight up have said something similar to that, but more bitchy than that. But
and then the laugh.
Laugh is. So I just saw this phenomenal play by Greli Duvall that's like, it was called Best Actress, and it was just her doing a celebration of scenes from all of her favorite actors or actresses. Not all ones that won Oscars, but just doing those scenes. Mm. And it was really fantastic and a celebration of like women's performances. And I was thinking, I'm like, her laughing would be one of the ones that I would do if I was doing this version of a show.
Yeah.
It's so good.
The line that really stuck out to me that I loved was Olwen, who played Mother Marlene, when she's leaving the gas station, when she's just like, "I'll see you later." Like, she doesn't say it the way that she delivers it, not like somebody who's in a horror movie, but like somebody who's genuinely trying to befriend somebody. But the movie is definitely just screaming at you that you're still in the horror movie. Is so it was chef's kiss.
So like, good.
She could have played that much more cartoonish. I'm in a big 80s horror movie, but she played it like an actual murderer. And I loved it.
Great line. Great lines all around. Some more great things. Best fits. We want to credit costume designer Alice. Oh, Jesus. A C tier. I'm going to go with a C tier. You can check out this segment in our Patreon page. It's a public page. What? You don't need to sign up for it, but we appreciate it if you do and see our best fits here. I went with the steal of... scene where, you know, we get a full frontal nudity with... I was going to call him Jeremiah Sam. What's the old boy's name?
Linus Roach.
Roach.
I didn't do this full frontal nudity to be called Jeremy Sands. That's what I'm doing.
I like that you're just talking about his dick. You go, we got to call him by his name at least.
So we get this
like a
scene
gentleman
with this whatever space age robe he has
that
on.
That robe.
And I think you're going to speak to that here in a second.
That robe.
But it's like we have to go from the highs of that costume. And then he gets humiliated. He goes out and does this whole, like, you know, performative, you know, look how I can get this girl to, you know, pull the trigger on a revolver, and I'm going to stab you in the stomach and burn your girlfriend. A really intense, emotionally, you know, draining scene. And then there's, what am I trying to say? It's almost like if you have a big argument or a big falling out with somebody, but you guys are still in close enough proximity that you have to like move past that moment. And it's like, what else happens past that moment? So after all of this, she's like burned to ash and then like just kind of like driving off, maybe to get ice cream or groceries for the night or whatever mundane thing they're about to do. It's like, what do you dress in? I guess he goes and just throws on this like leather jacket and these jeans. And this is like, it's like, what do you do after all of this heinous bullshit? And then you just move into the mundanity of it all. It was kind of weird just to see him and just like, this aviator's jacket jean combo and walking out from all of this while Nick Cage is still tied up and like watching his girl. It was just such a weird cut. That weird is not the right word, but it just stuck out to me. It's like, oh, that's interesting. That's what you threw on.
Yeah.
Like after all of this, like I took a shower, shaved a little bit.
Scrub off all the pageantry and just put on your fucking stunner shades and run down to the corner store. It's very cute.
It's weird. It's like, oh, it's unsettling.
What do you mean? Is a good fit though. I would fucking wear this. This is absolutely something that I would
absolutely not bet.
But like it's a ceremonial robe. He's like inducting a new person. And also think about it again. It's 83. This is what I was gonna say about it.
Yeah.
It is like the most dynasty meets cult wear. It's just the giant quilted the giant quilted bell sleeves mixed with the giant quilted shoulders, which are elements that you can actually even like see in the in like they're used in the costumes of in Rocky Horror.
Oh, the
original movie for Rocky Horror. I don't think like I don't know if they're like winking at each other or not, but like who knows. But that was a really popular like structural thing for like high end women's garments at the time.
Yeah.
So it's just such a like, yes, my space robe when we ascend. Like, and again, it's the fantasy of having the ceremonial robes. Like if you think about it, it's like when I'm Uncle Aunt, like literally before I take my wig off at the end of the night, whoever's like around me, I literally just shout out the illusion's about to be ruined. And so everyone's not like, oh God, what happened? A lot of things have changed.
It's literally,
I mean, it,
oh, no, keep going, yeah, go ahead. No, go.
I was going to say, it's just, it's a thing you put on the outfit for the job. So
I just like that we referenced Iggy Pop earlier, and the other half of that Venture Brothers scene, Klaus Nomi has the big wide shoulders like this.
Oh, yeah.
Outfit here. Yeah, he's explicitly got the kind of the silhouette of this vibe going on. My favorite part about this fit, it, just as a whole, like the very sci-fi, like elevated ridiculousness of the sleeves and the jacket and the shoulders, and then the just bathrobe tie off on the waist that completely ruins the illusion of it all.
Love that. It is something he made one of the girls make, one of the women make, guaranteed, and they had a limited amount of skill and they're doing their best.
Yeah.
And that's why the best part is the quilting part.
I love
it's the only thing they probably taught.
Great fizz all around. Let's jump into Behind the Lens, and we'll talk about the shots we loved in this film coming up after this. 5, 4, 3, 2. Welcome back from break. We're going Behind the Lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and its curtain close. Again, you can follow this segment along with our best fit in the show notes where we post on the Patreon. It's a free post. You don't need to sign up for it, but we do appreciate it if you do. We're talking about DP Benjamin Loeb. I'm going to throw it to McGee for his opening shot for shot.
So I think this film does something really interesting with its wide shots in general. Not just like there's a lot of interesting like skyboxes. I guess skybox is more of a video game term, but like just like wide shots like of sky replacement where they obviously at the end of the movie, it's like full psychedelic. But then the shot of them in the canoe that dissolves into the fire and stuff. They're just, there's so much texture and chaos in everything that it really, it sets the tone very well visually without like impressing too much story shit on you. Like we're not doing like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or like we're going to show you a bunch of like grimy, rusty, rundown shit. But there's just so much visual chaos happening, even in like establishing shots. It went on the rare chance when we actually get one that it the movie never really lets you like settle into anything, which I find very enjoyable.
Is it in its use of the contrast, the negative space? When you're saying some of the chaos elements, like what are some of the chaotic elements in those walls like, that you found like kind of?
The just like the wave pat where there's this like there's a little bit of repetition in the waves, but they're it's framed so that you're not seeing anything but waves, so it feels very isolated and alien in a way. And they do this the skies in a similar way where you're seeing like the clouds just don't look upright. The
right
where you know the light sources are just a little more. I don't know. I might just tell you to cut off.
No, I think I'm kind of with you because I want to. There is a feeling that this world resides in something familiar, like the Pacific Northwest. I think it's where it's like quote unquote set, but there is that alien and part of it's what he's doing, you know, with the color correction and the lighting. But part of it is just it does feel kind of outer worldly, particularly when we're in the we're getting into. The what were they called? The black skulls.
Skulls.
Yeah, like we're starting to deal with that. The way he handles like forest exteriors feels kind of really weird. It's just like something off, something odd. I don't think you're too far. I don't think you're too far off the mark with that at all.
I think it pulls into all the things about it being like almost a mythological tale.
Mm-hmm.
I know I keep bringing up Abraxas, but I don't know enough about it. But there are like little elements that I feel like I'm being gaslit in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Abraxas is like a Gnostic god of like chaos and order.
Mm.
So it's like the duality. And so I think that like, and one of the things, like when you see it drawn, which is drawn crazy, the feet are snakes.
Mm.
And
is that what that shot,
all
man?
all over the floor. It's like they're not necessarily snakes, but you have all over the floor in the chemist's lab.
Yeah.
You have like these millipede thingies.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if that would make him Abraxas in the sense that he represents chaos and order, and that he sees a wrong that happened and he's like, and I will set it right by not only letting the tiger loose,
yeah,
but literally sending him in the right direction. And he has a inherent knowledge of all those that have taken his acid to find them.
That's interesting.
And so mm-hmm. that's why we're going to the Shadow Mountains.
Really interesting.
But
fucking Chekhov's tiger. That, really thought that tiger was going to come up.
Chekhov's really, tiger. Yeah. Chekhov's like innocent person in a bag. Chekhov's,
I would have put so much money on that tiger showing up again later in the movie. And I was really honestly not looking forward to the tiger showing up again later in the movie. And so then I was very conflicted when it didn't.
No, I was in the way that I like love the, as much as I love like 80s heavy metal, I love the drag of 80s heavy metal. So yeah, having the moment where he's like roaring and I'm like, oh, give me that binder. Give me that Trapper Keeper with that on the front. Like, you can't tell me nothing. I'm going to totally pass math. But there's something otherworldly to where when you like, okay, so he is, and we see him turn down a beer in like the first couple scenes, and then he has to find where he's hidden a bottle of alcohol in the house.
Yeah.
And so it's like there's an implication of sobriety being completely broken once she breaks, he breaks.
Yeah.
And the idea of like the slowly but surely losing himself, which is why I stand up for like the prolonged too many shots, cigarette lighting shot, is because we're watching him slowly break down in a way that it's like, I think we don't necessarily celebrate media literacy in allowing those moments to sit. And yeah, it's indulgent, but I'm here for it.
Yeah, actually,
my favorite scene is in the bathroom.
Yeah, let's just jump into that shot. So we'll jump back into the bathroom shot of him in here, because I love this a lot. This actually reminded me a lot of Leo in the trailer for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a very similar idea of like just letting the actor kind of go through the full range of emotions, and parts of it get played for comedy, parts of it get really dramatic and sad. Like, I think like just cutting on the lights and he's in here with this, he's in the underoos, he's in this shirt, this tiger shirt, it sort of like matches the decor of the room itself. And it's funny at first. I think him just like psyching himself up to like drink the vodka like feels like a comedic moment, but then it like breaks into kind of like a really sad fucking, like when we sit down on the toilet and we kind of cut in, I don't actually have it in this gift that we created here, but there's a point when he sits on the toilet and then he like gets really sincere. Like, he starts, it feels like it's less of like the psyching himself up to drink and more of like he's starting to relive, like, you know, her being burned alive, and he's like kind of crying or like doing that like almost like an animal screeching or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, as it's lost something. It's really kind of, and then it kind of delves back in, I feel like, to a little bit of a comedic moment. I'm kind of forgetting the tale of this scene, but we do kind of cross a range of emotions in this room, in this wide shot that I really, as far as the color theory part of it, I love that we had this harmonious orange brown overlay over everything, but then, you know, the range of emotions in this, like allowing it to be played in the wide, I think it was a brilliant choice as well.
And I feel like there are rarely times that I love, like, I really value I really value when men are able to express themselves, because like we all live under the patriarchy. We all suffer under the patriarchy. The ability to express yourself and have that vulnerability is something like we really don't get to see all that much. And it does always, like, I mean, most times when we see it, media does end up going into like a rage filled murder spiral, which is what we do get in here. Mm-hmm. But I think that like us allowing us that time in the bathroom gives us time to watch like a man like going off of adrenaline, then hitting the reality, then hitting the anger, and then hitting the deep sorrow. And I feel like, I mean, that's like, I won't say it's endangered, but it at least like definitely hides from the female gaze a lot, unless we end up dying from it. Yeah, like I feel like that ability just is like sit in this mass, like this very masculine portrayal of these deep, deep emotions is like incredibly vulnerable and beautiful. I love it. I think it's beautiful.
And we'll move on to the our last shot is takes place in the courtship or the indoctrination,
the courtship abduction, of Mandy, yeah.
of Jeremy Sand,
non-consensual courtship,
where he's so this is the I love this entirety of this sequence of him introducing himself and what he thinks he is, and
yeah,
this, that, and the third. And there's a part where we cut into this a close-up of Jeremy's face that then begins to morph into Riseboro's face, and he's like speaking to her, and he's like taking on her features and still talking in sections, and it's a little subtle in places and then really definite in others, and they're smiling between each other, and there feels like there's going to be some sort of maybe connection before we get into obviously her laughing them off and just saying like this whole shit is ridiculous, dude. It's a yeah. I love this sort of like, it isn't a fake out, but it is this interesting melding of the two here in this one, or where we just keep crossfading, you know, the faces together, and they have a very similar skeletal structure to where, you know, they, or at least I'm assuming maybe.
Well, they're stabilizing it on the pupils is how it's really.
Oh, interesting. Talk to us, McGee. I know you like the shot too.
Yeah, because this is my favorite shot in the movie, hands down, for sure. But they're definitely like stabilizing it on the eyes and letting whatever else drift. But because they're so similar, most of the time the rest of it lines up. But the important thing is that like the eyes never really drift, so you can stay locked into the emotion of what he's saying, even when you're not looking at his, like even when the mouth isn't even mouthing the words anymore. It's fucking phenomenal. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant shot. Absolutely. I think it really also cool goes back to what you were saying about the chemist and like the snakes at his feet. For me, especially as somebody who's like enjoyed my fair share of Lovecraftian fiction and like cosmic horror, a lot of times these like my kind of headcanon for the events unfolding would be like the chemist finding some sort of otherworldly conduit that he's using as an element in the LSD. And so everybody, the reason he's able to identify where other people are is because by taking this tainted batch, you're all getting connected to this like old god that is both like,
I like that.
It's so you're losing your sanity as part of your mind is getting connected into this other universe, other universal being. And so this like Mandy actually being special in the way that like he's seeing her and he tries to connect her to it, and she's able to still just fucking laugh at how pathetic it all is, even while withstanding that connection, is like she actually is special, and that's why she's so appealing to him. But it's specifically that allows her to resist the like indoctrination of it all, and like all wrapping up in this like completely psychedelic shot I absolutely love.
And it kind of gives me my thing back into like my weird soft lore behind this, where I think that since she represents creation and nature, and all that Jeremiah is consumption, he does like he just like even the music he makes is about himself. Like everything he is consumption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's the wanting to own nature and then nature being like, baby, I can't be owned. I'm my own beast. I'm gonna be a storm. That being like a reaction and then immediately deciding to destroy it, I think is also just like, it's like such good false prophet vibes.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's love a very that. Important shot where he tries to like adopt her and she's like, pfft.
Right.
Yeah.
It's great.
Combo of craft. I'm going to say the combo of craft where the stars aligned is Nat bringing this to the table because I didn't think I was going to be able to handle it and it ended up being one of my favorite picks. I think this is
I'm not going to throw you Martyrs. Like okay. There are movies I will not throw you unless you ask for it. If I tell you you should watch it, it's because I think there's enough to make the intense part softer for you.
Okay, yeah.
So like Lovecraft Country. If you like this, you will be fine with Lovecraft Country.
Oh,
it
really?
Is phenomenal.
Oh, my God. I would love to talk to you about Lovecraft Country. There's,
okay.
There's, all, yeah, all I want to do in the world is talk to you about
Lovecraft
Country.
There's two episodes specifically that I need to talk to you about.
Really?
Okay. Oh, my God. It's so, yeah. One of them is gonna fucking, you're, it's, oof, woof. We'll circle back there because I do think there's interesting conversations to be had for sure. On my stars aligned though, I gotta talk about that fucking head squish at the end.
Ooh, I love
the fucking head squish. Is so good. It makes me so happy. I love building a prop for one thing and just like knowing exactly. And it's something this movie does well in general that I wanted to bring up earlier. And the head squish is indicative of is this movie never overstays its welcome on anything.
Mm.
It's very quiet and very indulgent. I think it lets Nick Cage get away with the indulgences as most out of anyone. Whereas, you know, there's a lot of like monologues and long shots and everything. There's some shots where I think they're like the bathroom shot specifically. That feels like they're one where they're like, we got Nick Cage. Let's just put a wide up and let him do it. Do his whole thing. And it like it's reward. It pays off. It was the right decision, but it does feel like a decision where they're like, yeah, we're just gonna stick out in the wide and let him fucking scream it out. But the fight choreography never overstays its welcome. And that's one of the I think my biggest praises for this movie is like when it descends into silly action over the top metal nonsense, it knows exactly how much light that its costumes can take and when they need to do something in silhouette and when they need to just do something quick and then move on to the next one.
I love that they did the black skulls the way they lit the black skulls the way they did, where it didn't give us too much, because if it gave us too much, it'd be really stupid. But the silhouettes are fucking insane.
Mm-hmm. And the chainsaw fight doesn't go on and on and chainsaw. On. It wraps itself up nice. Like even with the axe that I think is absurd. That's not how axes work.
I don't know. It worked really well in that movie. Yeah. The documentary we just watched, it worked great.
Wait, what do you mean that's not how axes work?
The whole point of an axe is having the weight in the head for leverage, and your hand should be able to slide down it as you swing it. So making the center of it like rigid and bladed is completely...
Next time I see you, I'm going to give you the biggest wedgie.
Yeah, like what?
I'm so dumb.
Pop it's, you silly and take your lunch money.
It's like making, it's taking the all of the weaknesses of every weapon and combining them into one weapon. It's one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. It looks cool with metal
and
shit.
It's easy to throw, it looks.
It looks super easy to throw and handle. It doesn't work as an axe. It doesn't work as a sword. It basically works as a dagger that you're very clumsy with.
Or is it a scythe because he's the fucking Reaper, brother?
But that's Eos.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Love that.
Don't talk shit about that axe in front of me.
I thought the axe looked pretty sweet. I loved the design.
What about the anime? What was your view on the animated sections?
I enjoyed them. I felt like they were a little stiff in terms of the actual animation, but I want them
to be a little deeper. I want them to have a little bit more meat to them.
Yeah. They should have done what the fucking Max did and his. I if it was like instead, because I don't think there was enough meat, like you're saying, like there was, it was just It didn't really add anything to the story or to the narrative. I think it would have been better to just have some like cloud tanks or like the psychedelic like oil projectors. I mean, that's more like 60s, 70s horror than 80s, though.
I got a little bit of like the Heavy Metal magazine sort of like feeling.
That's my thought, where it just needs, it's like telling my, and here's the thing, here's my compliment sandwich. It's something I don't have the ability to do myself. Like, y'all, if you get my secret stash, you might notice that my drawing ability is limited. So it's like I can't get on a high horse about how those are done. But I think that if someone would have done a, like, I don't know, done them in watercolors or something, or done something a little bit more frizzetta about it, I think we would have been.
Oh, that would have been sick. I would have been happier. Shit. Yeah.
It'd be so good. That's my thing, where it feels, every other part of it feels polished and exactly the way you can make this be rock and roll. And this feels like, I don't know, just crosshatch a little bit of the corners for me. Just like give me a little depth here.
I hear you guys. I'm definitely a little more sympathetic. I think, again, it feels.
Oh, I'm sympathetic. I couldn't do it myself, but.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm, or let me say forgiving, maybe. It works for me a little bit better because it reminds me of Heavy Metal, the animated film. So it's like it has
that's
a bit
one of my
of
favorite
that.
Movies I'm giving it that yeah. But I just need to be pushed a little harder
further
yeah
that.
Yeah,
so I do think I will be pressing play on this again probably this year. I'm not lying to you. I think around October I'm gonna spin this back because I was I'll watch
and it's a great season. One to show people, right? Because yeah. It trips them out.
Yeah. Oh, great pick, Nat. Great pick. Thank you so
I'm
much
so
for closing
glad.
Out the month with us. Yeah, this is amazing.
You nailed it last week, I think, when you said that the three picks were the like gateway drug. Like it was very much starting on weed, doing some mushrooms, and then going on a full LSD bender by the end of the month.
And then like, oh, I know the guy that makes it. He just dips his fingers in it, man.
Just licks his fingers while he's talking to you.
Yeah.
Take the wasp to the neck by the...
I feel like this movie is the like, oh, I don't do drugs. Well, don't worry. I'll just show you Mandy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you'll
then
feel like you're
and
on
then
drugs.
You're going to be like, yeah, you're going to stand up. Your legs will feel weird. It's great.
So I'm looking.
Yeah. I'm so excited about it. I'm so glad you like it.
Yeah. It was awesome.
I was ready to convince you into liking it for the next. You know, for the last hour and a half, but it was great to make it nice and easy.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I love our picks for next month. We're going to get into our theme, our new theme coming up for May after this.
The Sunday Night Movie.
All right, everybody. Coming soon here on Make Me Watch, we're covering our new May theme is All Work, No Play. Obviously, a play on The Shining, All Work and No Play, Make Jack a Dull Boy. We're talking about films where work is identity, obsession, or like quiet tragedy, sort of like a May Day theme or May Day energy without being like, you know, didactic, like we're actually in a plane going down May Day. But these are people in their jobs, in their workplaces, in their professions, that they're just kind of spinning out of control. Think Sorry to Bother You, Michael Clayton, Norma Ray, those kind of films.
Snakes on a Plane.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting sick.
That was one of the most fun times I've ever had in a theater. That genuinely was. I wore a little shirt that said "Please let me on my plane." And I had a snake holding a sign.
I would never.
I just acted like I was a protester.
But yeah, looking forward to this scene because I think we have a really awesome lineup of films. Some divas, some noir. It's going to be a beautiful blend.
Some dead dads on a beach. It'll be great.
So stick with us. Next week, we're doing Shooting Shit. We're going to have a little looser of a program. Me and McGee just covering the ish that we're effing with. And we'll introduce the film that we're covering for our May Day theme in that episode. So join us there. Nat, thank you so much for being here. Always awesome. McGee, you were okay.
Yeah. Just, if you'd start liking axes more, we'd be in a better place. But look at you.
I mean, you do have to stick around after the recording stops for my lecture on the physics of medieval weaponry. So,
if a whiteboard comes out, I'm going to do a crime. It's on record now.
Going full man.
And yeah, if you would, if anyone would like to be part of my secret stash Patreon outreach, just send in your email, or not your email, but I don't care about your email. Send in your address. You'll get a really, really weird package from me. And this next month, you might find out who Employee of the Year or Employee of the Month is. Employee of the Year. You know what? Employee of the Year. Employee of the Decade.
All work, no play. Coming up next one. All right, guys. I'll see you later.
Yep. Later. Meow.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.